Greetings once again from Denver, Colorado, the city right here in the middle of it all. You may have heard the news. But stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back to the show, where we focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. So good to have you with us as we sit here high astride the continent, here up near the Continental Divide. Beautiful Denver, Colorado. Glad to have you aboard. And here we are, we're past Christmas. We've made it past Christmas without any major... Well, there was one major problem, and that was the present that the Democratic Senate left under our collective national Christmas tree, socialized medicine, as I predicted weeks and weeks ago, that the fix was in, and there's pretty much nothing that could be done, because the law means nothing anymore, the Constitution means nothing anymore, right and wrong means nothing to the ruling classes anymore, but we'll get to all that. I want to start... I didn't get any good suggestions on the punishment for texting for teenagers, so I'll probably let that hang out there for another week, since it's the holidays and listenership is way, way down in the holidays. So I only got one sarcastic comment, and I don't know if it's even worth... I don't even know if it's worth talking about. It was kind of funny, but let's see. What did he say? There's a volcano. He suggested a timeout. And there's an active volcano where he suggested the teenagers be put for their timeout. I'm not sure I go in for all that, but we'll address that again next week. And no one called or emailed, I should say, since we don't take calls. No one called, no one emailed to interpret my dream. And I'll one more thing I realized about the dream later. Was that all of the registered offenders who were taking the oath in the dream, they were taking the oath so they could be released from prison. That's one thing I remember. Maybe that helps. I'm not sure why George W. Bush was involved, though. Anyway, we've made it past Christmas, and only the fabric of America has been destroyed by the Democrat Senate. And, well, we made it without any major terrorist attacks, thanks to the fact that Al-Qaeda's third string of bombers just can't seem to pull it off. Either that or a Swedish guy or a Dutch guy on the aircraft? He jumped and put out the fire before Abdullah Makhmutbulov, I can't remember his name, before he was able to blow up the airplane. So I suppose we can be thankful for that as we head into the new year here. But let's jump right into the events of the week, because there were some cataclysmic events, at least as far as the Senate was concerned, and some not-so-cataclysmic events, such as this Dateline Beijing, China, from the Reuters Wire. A man who killed and ate what may have been the last wild Indochinese tiger in China has been sentenced to 12 years in jail. Kang Wanyan, who's a villager from Mengla in Yunnan province, met the tiger in February while gathering freshwater clams in a nature preserve. He claimed that he killed the tiger in self-defense. Now, the only known wild Indochinese tiger in China, photographed in 2007 at the same wildlife reserve, has not been seen since Mr. Wanyan had his meal of tiger. Is it the last tiger in China? Reuters asks. And, well, there's a good chance that it is. There are some other tigers out there, Indochinese tigers, in the forests of Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, and Myanmar. But this may have been the last Indochinese tiger in mainland China. And that's just sad. But if the tiger tasted good, perhaps the Indochinese tiger will make a comeback. Unfortunately, the article didn't include any recipe suggestions for the Tiger and didn't indicate whether or not Kang Wanyan, whether or not he enjoyed it or if he ate it because he was just desperate and he couldn't catch any clams that day. Anyway, if he killed the tiger in self-defense, maybe he just looked at it and decided, well, it'd be a shame to waste all this tiger meat. And he cooked it up. But we don't know if he braised it. We don't know if he fried it or boiled it. We don't know if he steamed it and had it with rice. There's just no indication. So the Indo-Chinese tiger, with some good recipe suggestions, could make a comeback. So we'll have to follow that story closely as we move on through the events of the week. Let's go into the politics file from the Denver Post. Activist Maurice Joseph Schwenkler pled guilty last Monday to a second-degree misdemeanor for smashing windows at the Colorado Democratic Party headquarters last summer during the run-up to the election of Barry Ho. Mr. Schwenkler received a one-year probation and was ordered to pay $5,000 in restitution. Now, anarchist websites, according to the Denver Post, they raised money for Schwenkler's bail, and they identified Schwenkler as a transgendered anarchist who used the name Ariel Attack. Authorities have consistently identified him as a male. Okay, but well, you know, if anyone's uncertain of his gender, we're not uncertain here at the Weekly Worldview, and apparently the authorities are not uncertain of his gender, but Schwenkler himself appears to be uncertain of his gender, and that's sad. And it's a bit gross. But one thing he's sure of is his political affiliation. He worked for, let's see, who did he work for? No, it doesn't say. He previously had worked for a Democratic candidate. Initially, you'll remember, Democrat Party officials blamed conservative opponents of health care for stoking animosity directed at Democrats, leading to the smashing of the windows there in beautiful downtown Denver. And it turns out it was a transgendered anarchist slash Democrat supporter. Let's see. The gay and lesbian transgender protest group Denver Bash Back characterized Schwenkler as one of its, quote, friends and comrades, unquote. How appropriate. So another transgendered freak of nature ends up in jail. Well, no, he's not in jail. He's got to pay restitution, which I'm all for. I'm all for having him pay restitution. $5,000 for 11 plate glass windows. See, can we do the math on that? It's less than $500 per window. I'm not sure that covers it with labor, but hey, what are you going to do? At least perhaps the poor young man will have some time to ponder the nature of his gender. All right, on through the politics file. Speaking of Barry Ho, he gave a speech last week. I'm not sure where, but I pulled this off of RealClearPolitics.com. On Monday, this past Monday, Barry Ho said, in the long run, we can't continue to spend as if deficits don't have consequences, as if waste doesn't matter, and as if the hard-earned tax dollars of the American people can be treated like monopoly money. That's what we've seen time and time again. Washington has become more concerned about the next election than the next generation. So it appears that Barry Ho is not insane. His rational mind recognizes the destructive nature of his actions. You know, the hundreds of billions, trillions that he's been printing following George W. Bush's leads. You know, he's just the same actions of his Democratic and, frankly, of his Republican predecessors. So none of these people are clinically mad. So we're left to consider that they are indeed religious fanatics. Yeah, religious fanatics following a false god into suicidal behaviors despite the irrationality of it all. Could it be Barry Ho, George W. Bush, Bubba Bill Jeff Clinton, Bush the First? Keep on going back. Are they all just religious fanatics? Well, you know, if the current system of socialist government isn't corrected, the American economy is going to end up looking like Jonestown. And the body politic may suffer a fatal self-inflicted wound. Anyway, it's time for those of us who know right from wrong to stop operating within the bounds of these other people's religion. You know, and I'm not talking about a revolution. Just a godly life, godly child rearing, a godly church, and actions within the bounds of morality to change things for the better. And if we don't stand up and do it, well, monopoly money will be the last thing the next generation has to worry about. That's the first thing they have to worry about at the moment. But there'll be plenty more to worry about. Let's delve further into the politics file from Washington, D.C. A CNN story. Arnold Schwarzenegger, California's Republican governor, has given Obama high marks for his first year in office. In fact, he gives him an A on a scale from A to insanity. He gives him an A. Let's see. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Republican, says, when it comes to effort, Obama should get a straight A. He's out there with tremendous energy, and he's selling his ideas. He has great enthusiasm there. He's a great speaker and a great communicator. Unquote. So obviously steroids affect brain function and the powers of observation, if we pay any attention to Mr. Schwarzenegger. He also had some advice for Obama, according to CNN. Schwarzenegger says his advice to Obama, he has to hang in there. Be tough. Just continue on. Never give up. Eventually, he's going to get all those things done. Unquote. And I guess Arnie thinks getting all those things done is a good thing. All those things Barry Ho's trying to do. Destroying the fabric of the nation and all that. Well, according to CNN, the California governor was echoing the sentiments of New York City mayor and direct descendant of Lucifer himself, Michael Bloomberg. Bloomberg said he would give the president a pretty high grade. Bloomberg did. And he says, I would just urge him, if he doesn't get everything he wants, don't get beaten down. Don't go back into your shell. So these are two leading Republicans giving advice to the man hell-bent on destroying the country, turning us into a third-world socialist prison camp. Well, that might be a slight exaggeration, but only slight, I can assure you. All right. Let's go into the war file now. The war file is pretty thick this week. John Kerry, according to the Wall Street Journal, has suggested becoming the first high-level U.S. emissary to make a public visit to Tehran, Iran, since the 1979 Muslim Revolution. And the White House says they will not oppose John Hines Kerry traveling to Iran to have high-level meetings with the dictators and the mullahs there. You know, I saw the protesters this just on TV last night. You know, it seems like the Iranian regime is closer to collapse than it ever has been. So and instead of helping those inside Iran to topple the mullahs, Barry Ho and the Democrats are contemplating sending John Hines Kerry. High-level talks, engage them. Give them legitimacy. I can't help but hope that the trip happens, that John Hines Kerry does fly over there in his wife's private jet, and the dissidents topple the mullahs while he's meeting with them. That would be, and he ends up, I don't know, in a hostage situation. I think it'd be an appropriate end to Kerry's treasonous career. And I would not recommend a rescue operation if John Hines Kerry were taken hostage by radical Iranian students loyal to the United States. All right. Further on into the war file, let's see. Oh, now how did this get into the war file? Let's see. Apparently a Washington, D.C. police officer arrived at a snowball fight, and he drew his gun, and he's being roundly criticized. According to the Associated Press, hundreds of people were gathered on a D.C. street corner for a snowball fight during last Saturday's record snowstorm. A video posted on YouTube showed an officer waving and pointing a gun as he walks toward the snowballers. And, you know, I've heard all the criticism. And the way they report this on the news, it's as if a bunch of third graders were having a snowball fight and this cop shows up and pulls a gun. And if you watch the video, this wasn't an impromptu snowball fight. It wasn't a festive community activity organized by, you know, the local pastor, school teachers, the Rotary Club. No. Folks, it, you know, in Washington, D.C., a snowball fight can become a gunfight pretty quickly. I'm with the detective on this. I mean, it was a bunch of thugs throwing snowballs at cars, not a snowball fight, you know, in the fifth grade middle America sense of the term. And now I know why this got into the war file. I mean, this is the state of justice in America today. The police are basically under siege. They can't even walk into a snowball fight without having some serious concern for their own lives and the safety of the general public. So, I mean, if I stumbled across a snowball fight in Washington, D.C., I'm pulling my gun. Jihad. There is a story out of Alexandria, Virginia, from the Associated Press. There is a tight-knit Muslim community there in Alexandria, and it's filled with sadness and anger. Apparently, five young men who grew up with modest means, living in small homes and apartments with their families, and they all, you know, seemed to show signs that they were on track to achieve good things in their lives. They range in age from their late teens to their early 20s. They've been described by friends and neighbors as polite, quiet, even kind young men. They went to public schools, and some were even athletes. At least two of them were in college. Now, they're sitting in jail cells in Pakistan, suspected of trying to join militants who are fighting U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Yeah. They say these five young Muslims got caught up in what some call jihadi cool. Jihadi cool. That's apparently different from MTV cool or hip-hop cool. That just doesn't seem to be getting it done, for at least for these five young gentlemen. And I guess the fellow who tried to blow up the airplane, although he wasn't of modest means. I mean, the son of the lead banker there in Nigeria? Anyway, jihadi cool. That's the latest thing we've got to worry about. And I really think that this isn't really any different. This is nothing different. This is just another version of the same disillusionment that public school and a secular upbringing produces in your average, you know, white Christian kid. You know, it just manifests itself differently. You know, the Christian rebels by, you know, typically destroying himself and his close friends with drugs and sexual immorality, becomes a liberal, denounces his faith and all that. You know, where the Muslim, you know, he follows a similar path, you know. Add the suicidal and immediate destruction of everyone around it. But it's a very similar disillusionment. When you raise young people with no spiritual connection to the actual Creator, to the living God, and you convince them that they can satiate their lusts and be satisfied with life and things, well, at some point, they all realize it's really not true. And they desire achievement and meaning in their life that's larger than just their own life and their own stuff. And, it's a sad state of affairs for the average white Christian kid and for the Muslim kid who's conditioned in the public schools here in the United States toward emptiness. And, you know, we seek to fulfill the emptiness within ourselves. And we seek to do it in different ways. And when we don't have a connection with the Creator God, well, anything can happen. I mean, bombs can start going off, for crying out loud. All right. Back into the war file. From ABC, there was a policy put in place this past week by a general, General Anthony Cucullo. His policy was instituted November 4th, but it has triggered outrage among many women's groups since it became publicly known in recent days. He threatened to court-martial female soldiers who became pregnant while deployed in the war zone. Let's see. Yeah, that's what he said. Now, we have a quote from, let's see, it's got to be from some feminist. Let me see here if I can figure out who this is. Oh, it was a letter signed by, oh boy, here we go. A letter signed by Barbara Boxer, Barbara Mikulski, Jean Shaheen, and Kristen Gillibrand. Man, there's a quartet right out of a Munch painting. Scream indeed. Anyway, their letter said, "We can think of no greater deterrent to women contemplating a military career than the image of a pregnant woman being severely punished simply for conceiving a child." And isn't this convenient that Ms. Boxer, Mikulski, Shaheen, and Gillibrand, when it comes to their, ox being gored, suddenly the woman is conceiving a child. Now, if that woman wants to end the life of that child, well, it's not a child, then it's a fetus, a clump of undifferentiated cells. It's an inconvenience. It's a physical condition. But if a general wants to punish a woman for getting pregnant on the job, suddenly she's conceiving a child, and these lesbians, I mean, female Democrat politicians are lining up to declare that she's conceived a child and she's in a delicate condition now and she needs to be treated with kid gloves. It just shows the hypocrisy. I guess that's nothing. And now this is just on a personal note, okay? This is just my opinion. But I was in the service, and I'm convinced that if America's parents would raise more men, we wouldn't need girls in the military. Now, not totally. I mean, nurses, IT personnel, doctors, you know, that's fine. You know, but combat and combat support, auto mechanics, ordnance, artillery. I mean, come on. Do we really have to have girls involved there? And it creates trouble with the boys, trust me. Anyway, this poor general, Anthony Cucullo, he's already apologized. He's rescinded the order, the policy. I mean, he turned tail faster than a French brigade commander at the Ardennes, 1940. I mean, this poor guy, he's probably so far underground you can't find him with a GPS. He doesn't want to talk to anybody right now. Savaged by the lesbian brigades there in the House and Senate. All right, on into the war file. Boy, the war file is thick this week. Do I really want to do all this? Let's go back to jihad. Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, met with Diane Sawyer in a rather uncomfortable moment. She tried to hand him a 2-page document that, it claims, I mean, the document shows that Iran's been secretly working on testing a neutron initiator, the part of a nuclear bomb that triggers an explosion. The technology, according to experts, has no use aside from detonating a nuclear weapon. So she tried to hand him the document to get his opinion on it during their relatively uncomfortable interview. And Ahmadinejad said, No, I don't want to see this kind of document. There are some fabricated papers issued by the American government. Proves nothing. Okay. Anyway, he didn't take the document from Diane, who didn't have her head covered, by the way. Let's see, what else did Mahmoud have to say? He said, "I think that some of the claims about our nuclear issue have turned into a repetitive and tasteless joke," he said to Diane. And she giggled nervously and crossed her legs and just sweated. I don't know. It was just weird to see an American journalist, allegedly, sitting down with a potential mass murderer who's, I mean, it's just a matter of time before this fellow murders a million Jews. I mean, he sits up at night, dreams about it. And Diane Sawyer sits down with him. Anyway, get that memo out to Benjamin Netanyahu. Please, please do the right thing, BB. All right. On into the war file from Caracas, Venezuela, from Yahoo News. Who knew that Yahoo would have news? But they have news. President Hugo Chavez launched a federal police force last week. He says we are tackling one of our population's most sensitive problems, crime prevention. So Chavez has instituted a 950-agent force that will initially operate in the capital's most crime-ridden neighborhoods, but he plans to boost the number of officers to 6,000 and extend its reach beyond Caracas by the end of the year, according to Yahoo. We have a quote from Justice Minister Tarek Al-Assami. He says, the national police will impose a culture of peace in the barrios to eliminate the violence of the capitalist bourgeois model that we've inherited. Yeah. So Yahoo News, a highly credible source, tells us that armed robbery, kidnapping, and murder are widespread in Venezuela. Polls consistently show that most Venezuelans view violent crime as the nation's most pressing problem. This is interesting to me because, you know, I have been talking about the epidemic of crime and bloodshed here in the United States, and I have a concern that when people become overwhelmed with fear for their own lives and safety, well, they're likely to elect a government that will do anything because they're just worried about getting killed on the way to the grocery store. They're not so much concerned with socialist policies that will destroy the lives of their children for generations. And it's just a little creepy to see this happening down in Venezuela. It was revealed earlier this month, according to Yahoo, that police are involved in up to 20% of all crimes, particularly kidnapping and murder. Gabriela Silva, a 34-year-old street vendor, says you can't trust the police because you don't know if they're honest or not. And then she repeated a joke that some Caracas residents tell visitors. They say, if you get robbed, don't shout because the police might come. That's a sad state of affairs down there in Venezuela. And I would argue that we are teetering on the verge of a similar problem in certain, in fact, I'll bet certain parts of Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. are indeed just as violent and corrupt as the barrios of Caracas, Venezuela. Anyway, so the question is, can a socialist dictator solve the problem of crime for the people? And I would posit that yes, they can for a time. I mean, they have been known to make the trains run on time. And so Chavez is not to be underestimated. He's a very wily character, you know. This is a very astute political strategy for him too. And you know, remember, if it weren't for the full commitment of every effort of England and America, men like Chavez and Ahmadinejad would have ruled the post World War II world, and may have been ruling right up until now. So are we up to the challenge today, both at home and abroad, to take care of the crime problem and to take care of the socialist dictator problem, both at home and abroad? I think we probably are. It's just a matter of waking up the young men of America, which we're trying to do here at the Weekly Worldview on a weekly basis anyways, doing our best. So what else is Chavez up to? Hugo Chavez, according to Breitbart, he's announced a new chain of government-run cut-rate retail stores that will sell everything from food to cars to clothing from places like China, Argentina, and Bolivia. So he's going to sell cars, obviously following in the footsteps of Barry Ho. Barry Ho beat him to that one with GM and Chrysler. Chavez is also going to open a socialist fast food chain. Yes, he says, we're going to challenge all that junk food that just fattens people up. Yeah, he's going to open some socialist arepa stands. Not sure what an arepa is. Not sure how that compares to a Big Mac, but I suppose we'll see. We'll let the market decide. Let's see, they're going to sell vehicles imported from China, clothing from Bolivia. So, you know, Chavez is a crafty and dangerous, you know. But if left to his own devices and not allowed to make war, he'll eventually bankrupt Venezuela. You know, I would say within 3 years. Yeah. He'll bankrupt Venezuela within 3 years. It'll probably take him 1 year longer than it takes Barry Ho and all the neo-Nimrodians up there to bankrupt America. We'll be hot on their heels, and we'll all be eating socialist arapes. No more Big Macs will be available once Atlas shrugs. You and I am Doug McBurney. Let's continue in the war file till the war is over. This is a little bit scary for me. From Seoul, South Korea, from the Associated Press, South Korean's military said last Friday it was investigating a hacking attack that targeted secret defense plans with the United States. And the plans may have been stolen by North Korea. A South Korean officer failed to remove his USB device when he switched a military computer from restricted access intranet to the internet. The USB device contained a summary of plans for military operations by South Korea and U.S. troops in case of war on the Korean Peninsula. Well, authorities there in South Korea have not ruled out the possibility that Pyongyang may have been involved in the hacking attack, seeing as they used a Chinese IP address. I mean, do you think it might have been North Korea? China? I mean, I doubt it was some kid playing Grand Theft Auto up there in Beijing who decided he wanted to hack into South Korea's military defense computer network. Anyway, I always worry about China, and I probably worry too much. I don't know. I spent some time in Korea. I find it a very interesting part of the world, and it would just be a nightmare. If the North were to actually roll across the border there into the South, I mean, it would be horrible. And so I worry about that. But don't you worry. No. Don't you worry, because the day will be saved by Americans, right? Well, let's see how America's doing. From NBC News, a measure to legalize marijuana in California has gathered enough signatures to qualify for the November 2010 ballot. The Tax and Regulate Dope Initiative has far more than the 434,000 signatures needed to make the ballot, said a gentleman named Richard Lee, a well-known Oakland medical marijuana entrepreneur. A medical marijuana entrepreneur. We used to call those drug dealers. Well, you know, if you look at California, marijuana entrepreneurs may be the only entrepreneurs left before too long. All the other entrepreneurs are fleeing the state as fast as they can get out of there. They're so lucky they have a nice climate and good beaches in California, or everybody would have left last year. Let's see. Pothead campaign organizers say they will submit more than 650,000 signatures of registered voters next month to get on the ballot. And I don't know, I find this somewhat encouraging. I mean, if the potheads can get their people out of bed long enough to get legalized marijuana on the ballot, then the Christians out there should be able to organize the pro-life people to get personhood on the ballot. And I know they're working on that. Now let's see, the California proposal put forward by great Americans and supported by great Americans who are going to save the world. The proposal would legalize possession up to 1 ounce of marijuana for adults 21 and older. Residents could cultivate marijuana gardens up to 25 square feet if they could get out of bed. City and county, which potheads tend to get out of bed long enough to cultivate their marijuana. That's one thing they do get done before noon. City and county governments would determine whether to permit and tax dope sales within their boundaries. So Californians will no longer have to worry about the collapse of their state. You know, they can just get stoned and watch the pretty taillights on I-80 and I-15, dude, as they head out of California. Anyway, there's your Great American Report from the Culture File. And speaking of personhood, let's do a few items on personhood. We have something from the Associated Press. The way abortions are covered under the health care reform plan is a major obstacle to finalizing the legislation. Even though the House and Senate both agree no federal money should be used. See, they agree no money, federal money should be used. That's what they tell us anyway. Well, federal money should be used. The stumbling block, according to the Associated Press, over abortion, is whether insurance plans that get federal money are completely barred from covering abortions, or whether they can cover it as long as they require customers to write separate checks for the killing of children using their own money. Why does this matter? Asks the AP. And I ask myself the same thing. Why does this matter? They're going to set it up so that they socialize medicine and find a way to funnel money to people who butcher and dismember innocent people. But I'll tell you why it matters in the political sense, ladies and gentlemen, because the politicians who have fooled pro-life voters, both Democrats and Republicans, don't want their cover blown. That's why this question matters. That's the only reason this question matters. I have a quote here from Representative Diana DeGette, one of Colorado's leading advocates of the murder of innocent people. She says, "We want to see a health care bill passed, and we don't think it's particularly helpful for anyone to draw a line in the sand." Draw a line in the sand. So Diana DeGette, she's willing to compromise. Sure. The child killers are always willing to compromise because all they need is an inch. They just need an inch of compromise. You know, this proves that all the pro-lifers need to do is offer the smallest compromise, and the child killers will take it, knowing that they've won the larger argument, which is the dehumanization of the smallest, most innocent, most helpless persons. All they need is to win that argument of personhood. Look, if we're willing to discuss with them the means by which money is used to kill people, innocent people, of course they're willing to go with whatever we'll concede to them because they're worried about the larger argument, the killing of innocent people. They want to be able to kill innocent, inconvenient people, and they want to dehumanize them. They don't want them to have the rights of full personhood. So all the other arguments are just window dressing and cover for the bogus politicians who've been fooling you for 30 years. Let's see, they talk about Stupak. They talk about Ben Nelson. Let's see, Stupak's house language, you'll remember, allows insurers to offer separate rider policies that cover abortion. So Stupak, he's a real pro-lifer. He just wants a different set of paperwork if you're going to kill innocent people. Just make sure that's set up. Now, the Senate language would allow health plans that receive federal subsidies to sell insurance plans covering abortion, but those plans would have to collect separate premiums for the abortion procedures from customers and keep the money in a separate account. Yeah. So that, you know, that's similar to how Title X and Medicare fund abortion every day right now. So these so-called pro-life compromises succeed in two ways for the enemy. They dehumanize the smallest and weakest innocent people among us, and they provide politicians tolerant of child killing. They provide those politicians enough cover to fool all you gullible pro-lifers out there who buy into this garbage. Unbelievable. Let's see. I don't want to do that because I just don't care. I just don't care about abortion as it relates to that socialist healthcare takeover because I care about the larger issue, the humanity and the personhood of innocent people who are being killed. Let's go on. Let's see. More from the personhood file. Let's see. From One News Now, the headline yells out to us, "Amendment won't change much." While they typically support the principle of life beginning at conception, pro-life groups differ on support of for the Personhood Amendment, an initiative that is underway in several states. A Personhood Amendment, One News Now tells us, would amend a state constitution to define a person's life as starting at its biological beginning. Pam Fletcher, president of Missouri Right to Life, is in agreement with this definition of life, but, so always pay attention to what they say after the but she tells One News Now that passage of the amendment would unfortunately have no effect on the federal constitution and no impact on Missouri law. She tells us that the Supreme Court said in Roe v. Wade that it would not allow any state or branch of government to overcome the constitutional right to abortion as conjured up by the court by adopting a certain theory of human life. She says, and she warns pro-lifers who support personhood, she says, sometimes direct attack can lead to direct defeat, and that can be pretty devastating. Now, first of all, Ms. Fitcher, Pam Fitcher, it's either a direct attack on Roe or it's not. You can't have it both ways. You can't tell us it's not going to make any difference and then warn us that it's a direct attack. What are we, idiots? We know it's a direct attack, and so do you. You're just afraid. Like so many people in this country who are over 40, fat, comfortable, and afraid. You're afraid to head out there on the tip of the spear into the battle. And I'm glad that this attitude of sometimes direct attack can lead to direct defeat, it can be pretty devastating. I'm glad that wasn't Eisenhower's mindset in 1944. You silly woman. Anyway, what National Right to Life Committee and their sycophant chapters like Missouri Right to Life, what they don't understand is that the personhood effort is not meant as only a court challenge, but it's a means to increase social tension over what we have now, which is the well-regulated murder of innocent people. We want to raise, increase social tension. We want to draw a clear line between those who would regulate murder and those willing to take the risks to end it. Do we want a court battle? Yes, of course we do. We want to fight on every single front. Win, lose, or draw, we will proclaim the truth. That the truth that's revealed to us by God and His creation. Ms. Fitcher, as for me and my house, we will follow the Lord. You can follow your lawyers and their political strategery. And you can doubt and you can fear. But that's okay, Ms. Fitcher, because there are younger people who aren't as fat, old, comfortable, and afraid as you who are willing to take on this battle. All right. Let's see. We have a blogger on personhood in Nevada. Don't care. Really just don't care. Let's see. Oh, here's one out of Colorado. The Colorado Personhood Initiative is about more than merely outlawing abortion, according to Crystal Klinkenbeard. She's the communications director for the child-killing industry here in Colorado. She says a fetus has never been afforded full rights, not even before Roe versus Wade. And she may be right about that, because generally, the definition of a person strictly as it related to abortion was unnecessary since abortion was illegal. So we didn't have to fight on that front, Mrs. Klinkenbeard. Klinkenbeard said the issue of when life begins should not be simplified. She says creating a new definition for the word person in the Constitution is scary. It's scary because it could change everything from access to birth control services to the family's decision to terminate a pregnancy, even in cases of rape and incest, to property rights. Well, Ms. Klinkenberg, yes, abortion for rape and incest would be outlawed because we shouldn't kill a child because his father's a criminal. Let's see, birth control, not affected. That's a straw man. And since I've never heard of a fetus signing a contract, I'm not sure where property rights come in, but I guess when you're looking for a straw man, Ms. Klinkenbeard, any straw man that you can grab will do. She says this, the Personhood Amendment, is something that is completely untested in the United States legal system. The proponents of this initiative don't want voters to know how very dangerous it is. It didn't exist pre-Roe, and it's incredibly threatening to Colorado women and families. Those are women and families who advocate the killing of innocent people. It's very dangerous to them, Ms. Klinkenbeard. It might put you out of work. And it would put a lot of people at National Right to Life Committee out of work, frankly. And maybe they'd be glad for it. I know I'd be glad for it to just be over. Let's see here. Okay, out of Oklahoma City, not to beat this issue to death, but there's a lot of news this week. An Oklahoma County judge has extended a temporary restraining order that blocks enforcement of a strict abortion law. The law would require doctors to report personal information about women who seek abortions and for that information to be posted on a public website, and then you can kill the baby. That's a pro-life law. That was a law fought for by pro-lifers. The Center for Reproductive Rights and two women sued Oklahoma in September, saying the legislation violated a rule in the Oklahoma Constitution that requires one piece of legislation to deal with only one issue. Supporters have said the measure only deals with abortion. I mean, as you can see, it ends with, and then you can kill the baby, so it's obviously one issue, according to the pro-life industry in Oklahoma. So governing officials and some of the brightest, best-educated minds in Oklahoma are going to argue over vagaries in the Oklahoma law while the innocent are slaughtered. No matter which side wins, innocent children, the weakest among us, will continue to be slaughtered. So this is the strict abortion law fought for by pro-life Oklahomans? I mean, what a bunch of suckers. When the children cry, let them know we try. 'Cause when the children sing, then the new world begins. I am Doug McBurney, and this is the Weekly Worldview. Let's move on into the domestic tranquility file from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, a CNN story. A man described as a former employee shot and killed two people and seriously wounded another at a Baton Rouge construction company before workers wrestled him to the ground. The suspect is identified as Richard Matthews of Slaughter, Louisiana. Four co-workers held Matthews down until police arrived. He was escorted in for questioning, and in response to reporters' questions about the shooting, Matthews replied, "I couldn't get my unemployment. They wouldn't give me my unemployment." And so he murdered two people. Not a good problem solver, but obviously not afraid of punishment. Probably thought he'd be killed, probably suicidal. Dateline, North Haverhill, New Hampshire. This is from the Justice File. Three young friends who plotted the killing of a developmentally disabled Walmart cashier drew long prison terms last Monday. Timothy Smith, Anthony Howe, and Amber Talbot pled guilty to murder and conspiracy in the October 2008 death of 25-year-old developmentally disabled Walmart cashier Christopher Gray. Smith and Howe each got 40 years to life, and Talbot got 25 to 50 years. They took the developmentally disabled man to a mobile home under the pretext of watching movies. There, Smith and Howe, who are cousins, stabbed and strangled him as they stood around a campfire. From Milwaukee, Wisconsin, from the Justice File, a man who pled guilty in the killings of four people in Milwaukee on 4th of July in 2008 has been sentenced to 20 years in prison. He received 20 years for each charge, you understand, with the sentences to be served concurrently, which for all of you public school educators and public school educated out there, concurrently means he'll serve all four sentences at the same time. So let's, 20 years, ladies and gentlemen, for murdering four people. I suppose if you have murder in your heart and you're considering murder, at least in Wisconsin, instead of fearing a painful execution and fearing justice, I guess you just do the math. I mean, four people, 20 years, time off for good behavior. I mean, the guy could be out. Guy could be out in 12 years. Four people dead in Wisconsin. From the Justice File, From Billings, Montana, a 51-year-old Montana man with six drunk driving convictions has been charged again after testing nearly four times the legal limit for alcohol. Earl Leo Rock pled not guilty to felony drunk driving last Monday before a district judge. He was also charged with felony criminal endangerment, driving with a suspended license, and having an open alcohol container in the vehicle. Rock had had drunk driving convictions in 1991, 1995, 1996, 1997, and 2001. I don't know, maybe he did some, maybe did a couple 12-step programs there between 97 and 2001, but I mean, now here's a fella who just mocks justice because the government there in Montana allows justice to be mocked. I mean, how many times do you have to thumb your nose at justice before justice is imposed upon you? You know, in this case, now this is a repeat offender. One, two, three, four, five, six. This will be his seventh conviction, assuming he gets convicted. And since there is an open alcohol container in the vehicle and he has six previous drunk driving convictions, let's assume that the Montana governing officials out there, the Montana justice system, can find a way to once again convict Earl Leo Rock of drunk driving. But what happens to him? You know, in this case, one execution would prevent 1,000 repeat offenders. And I know people out there are, well, wait a minute, you can't execute someone for drunk driving. And I agree. No one should be executed for drunk driving. But contempt of court. Repeat offender is guilty of contempt of court. And you see, ladies and gentlemen, the authority of the court is a sacred authority. It's a sacred responsibility. So to thumb your nose at justice in the court is to shake your fist at the living God and to laugh at his justice system. And we can't allow that. We cannot allow that. So a repeat, I would say that, let's see, 1991, okay, fine. You get a caning. You didn't kill anybody. You know, we'll beat the flesh off the lower third of your body and send you home. But 1995 here, when Earl Leo Rock showed up in court the second time, that should have been it for Earl Leo. Should have been put to death for contempt of court. Anyway, so that's the state of justice. And why is justice so, well, laughable? Well, you know, it goes back to the state of the family. Yeah, the state of the family is a mess. Case in point, from People Magazine, which I don't read, but Drudge linked to it, one of Hollywood's most enduring relationships has ended. Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins have broken up after more than two decades together. They have two sons, Jack and Miles, aged 20 and 17. Sarandon and Robbins were admired in Hollywood for their long relationship in the face of the pressures of show business. Their much-discussed age difference, see, he's 12 years younger than she, and the fact that they never married. Yes, what had Susan said? I won't marry because I'm too afraid of taking him for granted or of him taking me for granted. Maybe it will be a good excuse for a party when I'm 80, said Sarandon. She implied that they would be married when she was 80, or together, I suppose, since they were just shacking up. But Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon have called it quits. By the way, the family was most recently seen in public at the Barry Ho inauguration back in January. Uh-huh. Yeah. She says that her family is not really that political. She calls it a family, but it was really just a shack-up relationship, and I guess 20 years is a pretty good stretch in Hollywood when you're just shacking up. But so there you have it. The state of the family mirrors the state of justice. All right. Now, from the Boston Globe here in the Culture File, the Boston Herald, Angela Mejia of Roxbury, Massachusetts, is among thousands of parents struggling with today's video game-obsessed youth. Mejia's son, one of four children she is raising alone, was playing Grand Theft Auto at 2:30 in the morning. An argument ensued, and Mejia unplugged her son's PlayStation. Then she called 911. Police responded and thankfully managed to talk the boy into shutting off the game and going to bed. She says, I called police because if you don't respect your mother, what are you going to do in your life? Well, you're going to be a loser. And if your mom lets you play Grand Theft Auto at any time of the day, your mom needs some guidance. Let's just say that. So she calls 911 to turn off Grand Theft Auto. That's the state of child rearing in America today. Is it any wonder that, and this kid one day will probably be a lawyer or a judge. Yeah. So we're in for interesting days. Dateline Columbus, Ohio. An Ohio woman who asked that police be called after she caught her 6-year-old daughter shoplifting says that she was trying to teach the girl a lesson early in life. She says, I don't think I went too far. She says, you got to catch them when they first start if they do something wrong. Now, Lyons, the mother, inquired at the police station about collecting a $30 reward for turning in shoplifters, but then says she decided not to collect the reward because she felt bad about doing that. She says, people think that I set my daughter up or something to get the reward. She says she's seen parents give children a light spanking in similar situations, but she felt that wasn't enough in her daughter's case. She is confident that her daughter learned her lesson. And I would say that, well, that all depends on whether or not she got the spanking. I mean, if she got the spanking, there's a possibility that she learned her lesson. But if you're a parent and you're at the point where you have to call police in a case of shoplifting, well, you need some guidance. What can I say? I mean, that's just a sad state of affairs for the future of Western civilization in general. Dateline Wichita, Kansas. A judge ruled Tuesday that Kansas law doesn't allow a so-called necessity defense in the trial of a man charged with killing one of the nation's few late-term abortion providers. You'll remember Scott Rader confessed to shooting Dr. George Tiller in church back in May, and his lawyers tried to say it was necessary to save unborn children. The Kansas Supreme Court said that allowing a person's personal beliefs to justify criminal activity to stop law-abiding citizens from exercising his rights would not only lead to chaos, but would be tantamount to sanctioning anarchy. And I happen to agree with the Kansas Supreme Court to a degree on this. They made the right decision despite some faulty reasoning there. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into all the ins and outs as to why we cannot shoot abortionists. I mean, not that we're not able, as Mr. Rader aptly proved, but it's outside the bounds of morality. And I will link to the worksheet over at American Right to Life that will help you to understand why we cannot shoot abortionists. Dateline Tokyo from the Reuters Wire. A Japanese man has married a character in a popular video game, taking her and his handheld game console on an overseas honeymoon. The two got married a few weeks ago, broadcasting their ceremony live on Japan's version of YouTube. The man, who did not want to reveal his name for fear of being misunderstood and possibly embarrassing his parents, he didn't want to reveal his name. He said, He admits to being an otaku, which is a breed of Japanese youth obsessed with video games, computers, and fantasy worlds. He says if more people were to find ways of expressing themselves like this, marrying a digital character, I think it would make society a bit more interesting. Interesting. Okay. One of the games he's obsessed with, Love Plus, has voice recognition software. So he says it's possible to have a sort of conversation with his new digital wife and even play simple games such as rock, paper, scissors. Pretty deep relationship. He also vowed to have and to hold for better or for worse, even if another updated version of the game is released. He says, I think I'll probably continue playing Love Plus with my new wife. I won't cheat, he says. An otaku from Tokyo. All right. That's it for the Worldview. I want to thank KGOV.com, Denver Bible Church, Personhood USA, American Right to Life, Theology Online, Colorado Right to Life, and of course my other brother Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you next week. Until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.